Ready?
Ready on the left.
No. This is so much better for staff.
I can print it home because we don't have a computer at home. So I just need to plan.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City Council meeting for the City of Arroyo Grande. This is Tuesday, February 12th. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Guthrie.
Here.
Councilmember Ray.
Here.
Councilmember Brown.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello.
Here.
And Mayor Ferrara.
Here. Item 3 is our flag salute. We're pleased this evening to have Thomas Epikarian from the Arroyo Grande Rotary Club, who is here to lead us in the flag salute. If you would, please remain standing for our invocation. Pastor Randy Wimette from St. John's Lutheran Church is here to do that for us this evening.
Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Let us pray. O God of all governance and true community, we humbly ask your presence and your power so that all our leaders be led in their thoughts and their words to produce decisions that are fair and just and compassionate. We ask also, O Lord, your presence and power so that we residents and citizens be led in our thoughts and our words to respect those we elect. Bind us out of our diverse needs and convictions into one common path for our community. We ask for your light and grace at this evening's meeting and always. In your holy and precious name we pray. Amen.
Thank you, Pastor. And Thomas, we need to hear about Rotary. What's going on?
Well, I put some things together. The last time we were in here, that I was actually here, we had just finished up our chili festival. We've used some of that money to go towards the community, and we're working on our scholarships that are coming up here towards the end of the school year for the students. Something else that's been going on is we just finished up our sing-along in December about a month and a half ago. Had a pretty well sold-out show at the Clark Center. And again, what we're doing with that is we're using that money to go back to the local schools for music programs or arts. So we're really trying to work on giving back, and we're hoping to have more and more scholarship money this year. And in May, we're also going to do a Rotary Relay for the local middle schools. So that's thank you for having us.
Well, wonderful. Thank you for being here. We hope you'll come back and lead our flag salute again for us. Okay, moving on to item 5, agenda review. We have no closed session announcements at this time. 5B, move that all ordinances presented for introduction or adoption be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. Item 6 is special presentations. And we do have one this evening. This is an honorary proclamation declaring February 26th, 2013, as World Spay Day. And we're very pleased this evening to have Mary. Is it Booner Kemper? Is Mary here? Did I murder that? Okay. If you would meet me at the podium, and I'm going to step down and present this. This is an honorary proclamation recognizing February 26, 2013 as World Spay Day. Whereas pets provide companionship to and share the homes of over 71 million households in the United States, and whereas humane societies and animal shelters have to euthanize millions of animals each year, many of whom are healthy and adoptable due to a lack of critical resources and public awareness, and whereas the problem of pet overpopulation costs the taxpayers of this country millions of dollars annually through animal control programs aimed at coping with the millions of homeless animals, and whereas spaying and neutering has been shown to dramatically reduce the overpopulation of pets, and whereas veterinarians, national and local animal protection organizations, private citizens work together to ensure the spaying or neutering of more than 49,000 pets through World Spay Day in the United States in 2012. And whereas veterinarians, national and local animal protection organizations, and private citizens have joined together again to advocate the spaying and neutering of pets on World Spay Day 2013. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Tony Ferrara, Mayor of the City of Arroyo Grande, on behalf of the City Council, do hereby proclaim February 26, 2013 as World Spay Day and encourage the citizens of Arroyo Grande to observe the day by having their own pet spayed or neutered, or by sponsoring the spaying or neutering of another person's pet. Mary, it's a pleasure to present this to you, and we'd invite you to say a few words.
Nice to be here again this year. Thank you for having me here tonight. My name is Mary Buna Kemper, and I'm a volunteer with the Feline Network. Our group works with homeless cats and kittens in South San Luis Obispo County, but tonight I am here representing all the animal rescue and welfare groups of the county. Spaying and neutering has proved to show that it is the most humane way to combat animal overpopulation. Overpopulation meaning that there are more animals than there are homes available. That animal health and safety improves and that cost taxpayers through animal control programs decrease. Our county is fortunate to have multiple organizations that maintain programs to get dogs, cats, and rabbits spayed and neutered, or assist the public to do so. Thus, our county's euthanasia rate is lower than the national average. To name just a few, these groups include Animal Services, Woods Humane and Slow, North County Humane, and there is a new group in North County working with feral cats called Paws Cause. And there's many other groups. However, not everyone is still educated or worse cares, or the proverbial, I have been meaning to get Fluffy spayed, but breeding season is upon us here in mild coastal central California. And actually, there is no season. It's so mild here, they can have 2 and 3 litters a year. Now is the time to have your dog, cat, or rabbit spayed or neutered before a litter arrives. A little more about the Feline Network specifically. We work specifically from San Luis to Napomo. Our main program is our spay-neuter certificate program that we provide to the public that require financial assistance who otherwise may not afford to get their cat or kitten spayed or neutered. In this instance, this could be their own pet or a feral animal that they are caretaking with food, water, and shelter. The residents of Arroyo Grande, especially the Mesa area, do call upon and make use of this financial assistance. Thank you, City Council of Arroyo Grande, for recognizing the importance of spaying and neutering by issuing tonight's proclamation.
Thank you, Mary. Appreciate you being here. Okay, that takes us to item 7, community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for members of the public to come forward on items that are not on this evening's agenda. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking any formal action on matters not published on the agenda. We would be interested in any of your comments, suggestions, and observations. Please limit your comments to 3 minutes or less, and please direct your comments to the council as a whole. Anyone who would like to come forward?
Mr. Mayor, members of the council, staff, and residents of Arroyo Grande. I'm here on behalf, I'm Bob Lund, by the way, 1202 Linda Drive, Arroyo Grande.
We know who you are.
I'm here on behalf of the Village Improvement Association this evening because we have an upcoming event I just wanted to share with all of you. And that is, we have the Horseless Carriage Club of America joining us a week from today from about 11 to 3 p.m. over at the Heritage Square Park. They will be bringing about 45 pre-1916 cars, and they are classic, beautiful cars, plus 120 or 130 of their members, many of whom will be in period costume. They're very proud of what they do. This is their annual convention they're having, and they're visiting Arroyo Grande for a day. So I encourage everybody to join us. We're going to have a band playing 1920s jazz music, a Crustacea band at the Rotary Bandstand. So have everybody please come and join us. Thank you.
Okay. We gave you a little bit of slack, Bob, because it's that item actually is on the consent agenda tonight, but that's okay. Okay. Anyone else who would like to come forward?
My name is Bill Hart, and Councilman, Mayor, staff. I have an idea that I want to approach to you guys to think about, put in the hopper. It's a dream, actually, and some people think that old men dream, and maybe I qualify, so I don't know. In Arroyo Grande, we have a historic resource that is in an environment that is just marvelous. And I would love to be able to see that this entity gets used by the general public. And what I'm speaking of is the Methodist campground and the tabernacle. And my dream is that the city works in a partnership with the church to open up the campground and the tabernacle as a public park where people, citizens, can come in and go freely, whether in and out, and that it's not necessarily private or restricted. Years ago, actually, I believe that the tabernacle is one of our most historic resources that we have in the city. But years ago, this is the function that it served. They had revivals there, but they also had Chautauqua. And I don't know if you're familiar with Chautauqua or not, but Chautauqua, in the words of Teddy Roosevelt, was Americanized adult education. It brought culture to the hinterland. And they would have plays, they would have recitals, they would have poetry reading, they would have drama, opera, and they would have lectures. And as it worked in Arroyo Grande, because there was this campground, and it happened this way all across America, especially Western America, people would come for 3 or 4 days and camp out. And then they would go to these events that would happen here. And I really see that we just have a jewel here that is just marvelous. And most people don't even know about it. Yet it's just really pristine. It hasn't really changed a whole lot in the last 100 years. And so my idea is, or my dream is somehow, some way, somewhere, that the city and the church can work together to really benefit the community and bring a really an unusual event, an unusual location to the benefit of our community. So I'm telling you my dream. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Anyone else who would like to come forward?
Good evening, Mayor and Council. My name is Brad Snook. I'm the chair of our county's chapter of the Surfrider Foundation. I'd like to start by reviewing some of the issues that have come to our community since I've been in front of the council. Coastal Commission was in town in Pismo last month. A few issues the chapter was there to address. Seismic testing, the impacts of high-energy seismic testing as proposed by PG&E. The permit was denied by the Coastal Commission a couple months previous. Just wanted to solidify that issue. The chapter continues to investigate low-energy seismic testing, which includes cannon blasts up to about 224 decibels. 145 decibels is enough to create seizures in Navy divers. And the permitting process is not as stringent as with the high energy. So the California State Lands Commission offers one-year permits, and companies that have the permits can go out and do low-energy seismic testing essentially wherever they want without a thorough environmental review. And that includes cannon blasting into marine sanctuaries and marine protected areas that we've worked hard to put in place as a community in California, and realize that those are valuable assets for both as fisheries and for tourism. So we're working with the State Lands Commission to investigate whether the permitting process should be reevaluated and then changed to more modern standards. The Morro Bay Wastewater Treatment Plant, the community of Morro Bay actually asked the Coastal Commission to deny the permit, and now they're investigating a good site for that plant to be built away from Morro Rock, out of the tsunami plain and a flood zone, and to a place that can be located more where water recycling makes a better sense. So most of that reclaimed water will be used in agriculture. We'd like a similar type of process to evolve here in South County, where we look at our plant in Oceano and move it away from the floodplain that it is in now to a place where water recycling makes more sense and water reclamation. And we have about 2.5 million gallons a day that we could be reclaiming from Oceano, Grover Beach, and Arroyo Grande. Also, the Sanitation District was at the Sanitation District meeting last week, and Mayor Peterson came and spent about 25 minutes, present a spreadsheet that showed district finances since 2006, trying to tie a lot of county numbers and different audits and information from the district together. And we applaud Mayor Peterson's effort. She's one of the new members there on the board. We think that Mayor Peterson's efforts will be rewarded in the long term, as some of the difficult questions that need to be asked of the district will start to be answered. And water quality issues also. That's an old plant, went online in the 60s. Of course, it's going to have problems. But the people of this district pay the sanitation district and the board of directors to make sure that the standards of the discharger's permit are met. That's what we pay for. That's what's expected, and we hope that the sanitation district takes that seriously. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Anyone else? Okay. We will close public comment or community comments and suggestions, and we will move to item 8, which is our consent agenda. This is normally a group of items that the council approves in one action, unless there is an item on the consent agenda that a member of the council would like to pull for further discussion, clarification, or an independent action. If you're following along on the agenda this evening, we're going to be addressing consent items 8A through 8I. And this is also an opportunity for members of the public to come forward on any of the items that are on the consent agenda tonight. And I would invite you to do so at this time. Once again, please keep your comments brief. Anyone who would like to come forward on any of the items on the consent agenda? Okay, seeing no one, we'll bring this to the council. What is the will of the council this evening? Any items to pull? Okay, we have no items to pull. I'll entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda in its entirety.
So moved. Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, anything to read in there tonight,
Tim? No, Mayor Furrer.
Okay, roll call, please.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Ray?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Moving on to item 9, public hearings. 9A is consideration of a staff project 2000-005. It's a review of our draft historic context statement. And Teresa and Ryan, good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. Ryan's just loading this PowerPoint, and we'll give the presentation momentarily.
Mr. Mayor, members of the council. This is a staff project. It's been in the works for quite some time, dealing with our historic context statement. Just to kind of go over a little bit of background, I don't know why this thing's beeping. A historic context statement, sorry about that, serves as a basis for the systematic evaluation of the city's historic resources, so in that way it acts as a framework for that evaluation. It's not intended to be a detailed history of the city, not comprehensive, but basically hit on the highlights. And it's also meant to be continuously updated and refined as new information becomes available. Our framework is broken into several components. This includes a historical background, which again, instead of being super detailed, is more of a broad brush approach to the city's history. It identifies important themes, patterns, activities, and influences. Breaks it down by property type. This can be residential, commercial, agriculture, industrial, etc. And it also includes some goals and priorities for implementation, which I will get to shortly. The context statement includes 25 historic resource recordation forms, and the purpose of those forms is basically to provide a record of evaluation by a qualified professional. The idea is that over time, these surveys will help build a more complete record of the built environment for our area. This information is then added to the California Historic Resource Information System, or CRIS, through submittal to the Central Coast Information Center, which is our local clearinghouse for that type of information. And just to want to make this clear, it was in the report, but I think there was some confusion over the matter that the surveys themselves, whether they're adopted as part of the context statement or not, do not convey a historic designation. They're purely informational, and any designation of a property or a district continues to be subject to the provisions of Rio Grande Municipal Code 1616.135, and that includes the process and the required findings to make such a designation. As I mentioned, there are additional goals and priorities identified as recommendations in the context statement itself. These are to submit the survey findings to the Central Coast Information Center, which again is the clearinghouse for that type of information. They would screen it and then forward it on to the Office of Historic Preservation, where it's entered into the statewide database. They basically would look at the forms, cross-reference the preparer with the resume they have on file to make sure it was a qualified professional that made that evaluation and conclusion before sending it on to the state. Another recommendation is that the City of Rio Grande pursue status as a certified local government. This would enable the city to become eligible to receive grants and aid from the Historic Preservation Fund administered by the OHP. And finally, we have a recommendation to adopt and enact a Mills Act program, which basically functions like a Williamson Act, but for historic properties. This gives property owners an incentive by decreasing their property tax once they enter into a contract with the city. Their end of the contract is to maintain their historic property in historic character and not let it fall into a state of neglect. Just to go over a timeline, as I indicated, this has been in process for quite a while, starting in June of 2013 when the Historic Resources Committee reviewed 7 requests for proposals for this project. On July 9th, the Historic Resource Committee met with 3 consultants, each of which presented their proposal to the committee. Then, with a recommendation from the Historic Resources Committee, on August 10th, 2010, the City Council authorized a contract in the amount of $29,800 for a services agreement with the consulting firm of Page and Turnbull. Page and Turnbull provided the city with an initial draft in December of 2010. The HRC reviewed that draft and felt that it was lacking in several areas. So after going back to the consultant, they agreed to prepare a second draft. This was presented to the HRC in November of 2011, and during this almost year time period, It involved a lot of back and forth between the HRC providing materials that were then forwarded to the consultant for incorporation into the second draft of the context statement. Then the HRC began the review of the second draft of the context statement, making several revisions over the course of almost a year, and ultimately recommended adoption of the revised context statement in September of 2010. We then took that revised context statement to the Planning Commission in December of 2012, then forwarded that recommendation to the Planning Commission in December of 2012, where the recommendation there was adoption of the context statement. Just to go a little more into the process of how we got here, the Historical Resources Committee revised the content of the historic context statement, adding several passages into the text. We did forward this revision back to the consultant, who reviewed the revisions, and they came back with several suggested minor changes. This was kind of all presented to the Planning Commission in December. The Planning Commission recommended adoption of the context statement as revised by the HRC with incorporation of the minor changes as suggested by the consultant. So we did go back to the HRC in January and got all those incorporated into the document you have before you tonight. Moving on to the surveys, the Historical Resources Committee disagreed with the conclusions for five of the properties that were surveyed. Staff looked at this and then recommended, and the Planning Commission concurred, to exclude those five properties since there is some disagreement on the basically the status code that was reached for each of those properties, basically to set those aside and forward on the 20 that there was agreement on to the Central Coast Information Center for inclusion into the statewide database. Just to run through the properties that would be excluded, in the staff report and context statement, these are identified as properties number 9, 15, 18, 21, and 22. One of the properties, number 9, at 408 and 410 East Branch Street, the HRC felt that the consultant's designation of 5B should actually be changed to 6Z, so that would be viewed as sort of a downgrade in potential status, whereas the other four would be an upgrade from 6Z to 5B. And this staff report just includes some sort of broad points that the HRC raised in their discussions over why they disagreed with the consultant's conclusion. Just to go over what would happen to the excluded properties, we have several options, the first of which would be to provide additional information to the original consultant, Page and Turnbull, for their reevaluation. If they agree that they're based on this additional information to change the status code, they could then be forwarded to the Central Coast Information Center. Alternatively, information could be provided to a different consultant for a new evaluation. Or the city may evaluate those properties itself with available information pending its certification as a certified local government. I do want to point out one correction to your staff report on page 86. It includes the table of all 25 properties, but incorporating the recommendation from staff and Planning Commission, those five properties would be stricken from that table completely and not part of the context statement and also not forwarded to the Central Coast Information Center. And with that, the recommendation before you tonight is to adopt your attached resolution, which would then adopt the historic context statement and also direct staff to submit the survey findings for the 20 properties that everybody agreed on the conclusion, to pursue status as a certified local government, to begin work on a Mills Act ordinance, and also to continue to conduct these historic resource surveys, again, adding to our overall inventory and record of the built environment. Alternatively, the council could modify and adopt the attached resolution, not adopt the attached resolution, or provide direction to staff. And be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Okay. Before we go to questions, obviously the Planning Commission and the HRC was a very big part of this, particularly the HRC. We have members from both of those bodies here, and if any of you would like to add anything to the staff report, this would be an opportunity.
Huh. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of council. First thing I want to do is say thank you to Ryan. He's leaving us. He's been a terrific help to us. He came on board after three other staff members had left, and he really did a yeoman's job. He's been terrific, and we're going to miss him a whole lot anyway. Thank you, Ryan. I also want to thank a few other people who were involved here, and one is Jane Line in the South County Historical Society for recognizing the importance of the historic context report and for her encouragement of the HRC and staff to pursue this report. I also want to say thank you to Charles Porter and Gene Hubbard for their time and contribution to the committee's review of the report. They provided some invaluable information. As Ryan pointed out, we found the initial draft to be lacking in depth and character of the Rio Grande's history, and we therefore attempted to enhance the document by conducting our own research and by using collective memories of the committee members. I should point out that I think it's been pointed out already that four of the five members go back several generations, and Bill Hart will speak to the committee's approach to the research.
Is Shirley here?
Shirley will be here.
Oh, okay. Okay. The consultant, as Ryan points out, surveyed 25 of the buildings in the village and submitted their findings. We conducted our own survey of these buildings, and based upon our findings, disagreed with the consultant on five buildings, has been pointed out. And they've been omitted from this report tonight. I would like to point out that, however, that in the staff report, the HRC's findings on these five buildings are listed but not adequately represented in the report. There was much more to that than what's in your report. Staff also alludes, Ryan did such a thorough job, I want to make sure I'm not... The issue of whether or not these five buildings go back to the consultant, Ryan started to get into a little bit there. It's my belief that under our ordinance, we can conduct our own reviews and compile a list of locally historic resources, and this issue needs to be fleshed out, and we've started discussing it with staff, and the issue leads to the discussion of the CLG, or Certified Local Government, also. Shirley will be here soon to speak about the methodology of our survey work on the buildings. That's my report. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, council members and mayor and staff. And again, thank you, Ryan, too, for helping us and also kind of relaying it out in such a logical way of what has happened. My comments will be basically addressing the process why we ended up reworking Page and Trimble's report. One of the things that we found is that at the beginning in the interview, they have an excellent reputation. But we found that when the report was brought back to us the first time, they had a significant turnover of employees. And it just wasn't, I think, up to their speed. And so we spent a lot of time finding documents that we sent them, piles of documents to indicate positions that we thought that they should understand, and so to no avail. It really came back when we came back the second time. It was a smoothed over version of the first one, and so we decided as a committee that we really needed to have a better in depth report. Things that that were missed on the reports. For instance, primary sources that are credible, are important to have, and primary sources such as the history of San Luis Obispo County by Myron Angel, the history of San Luis Obispo County by Annie Morrison, the Hell Recorder's newspaper during the time of this period, which is listed in the Clevenger clippings. Those things were not even listed in their bibliographies. And so we were concerned that they had missed primary sources, and even some of us on the we've laughed on the committee that even maybe one or two of us were primary sources, that we were that old or young, whatever you want to say. We also found other things that were really important, and I would like to recommend for you, if you ever have a chance of, I know you guys read a lot, but. We had a young man that is working at the Dan Adobe that wrote, it's called Growing Conflict. It's the story of agriculture in South County between 1837 and 1937. It deals with Napomo and Arroyo Grande, and it's incredible about what it talks about and how the culture of Arroyo Grande developed. And it's really basically it all started around the soil, and then it talked about the immigrants coming in. We're talking about that worked the farms. One of the problems we found was that, for instance, the Filipinos had a very, very important part of developing Arroyo Grande's agriculture and in the community, as well as our mayor here, in the 30s and the 20s, and yet there wasn't very little mention or none at all of Filipinos whatsoever. So we just didn't think that they gave a broad enough view, basically because I don't think that they had enough dollars and enough time. Maybe we were expecting more out of it than we got. We thought they were going to do something different. So anyway, long and short of it, that was the reason why it's taken us such a long time to get involved into this document that we have now. We hope that you find that it's interesting reading. There's a lot of things that we as the committee didn't know that in researching it. And I hope that you find it interesting, too. Arroyo Grande, in terms of the city, was impacted heavily by national and social politics, as well as the state, in terms of suffragette and prohibition and those issues. And then it's the soil. Arroyo Grande is the soil. And it was also, if you didn't catch it, in a survey in the 1890s, I believe, by the University of California, it declared taxes, our understanding is taxes were based on soil quality. And Arroyo Grande Valley here was ranked number one. There's one other location in the state that had the equal vitality of the soil, analyzed it in different ways, but it ranked number one in the state. That's why people came here. And that's why we have small farms and how it developed. And so when you have that, when you look at historical context, we put on these lenses like glasses and we go back into history, and that's how we see how Arroyo Grande was developed. And those are the major themes that come through, and that's what's important for us. That's our heritage. And that's why we have a historic village, and that's why we have a right to farm ordinance here in Arroyo Grande. Because that's who we are. So thank you very much.
Okay. Anyone else who would like to add to the staff report?
Hello, I'm Shirley Gibson, former HRC member, now just a member of the public. And congratulations to Ryan. I heard he's not going to suffer anymore with the HRC. Okay, so what I wanted to talk about a little bit was how the context statement and the survey are kind of a living document that need to be refined and added to over time as we find more information and we can, you know, include that in both projects. So I'm going to do a little bit of show and tell about the building that where the Village Grill and the baseball card shop is. And
Shirley, before you go on,
yeah.
just want to clarify, just for the sake of the process this evening. Uh-huh. Staff gave a report, and then so what I asked for was a representative from the HRC and the Planning Commission, mm-hmm. if they had anything to contribute to the staff report. We haven't yet gone to public,
okay, and you want
public
me to wait?
Hearing portion of it. You can go ahead and continue on if you want, but we do have the public hearing portion mm-hmm. upcoming.
It's,
so
your, it's up to you.
Well, you're here, so why
yeah,
don't you go on,
okay.
but just for the clarification
and
for the audience.
It's informational, so... Okay. So that particular building was found non-historic by Paige and Turnbull. So I wanted to take you through the process of how I came to a different conclusion. So on the first page, you can see the photo, and then according to their information, it was post-1931, according to a fire map. Well, that is correct. But through research, I was able to find out it was actually built in February of 1937. So I think the thing to keep in mind is Page and Turnbull actually did a foundation, and then we can build upon the foundation. And so I think when they reached their conclusion, they might have not had enough information. Okay, and then on the back side of the first page, they didn't know the historic name. Well, it is the Conrad Building, and Howard Conrad was part of the family that has the house across the street owned by the city. And then it was built as a grocery store and a drug store. And then you can see Howard Conrad was the owner, and Hugh Clark was the contractor. And then the next page goes way back to the original building that was on that site, and that was the Ryan Hotel, and that's this page. And it was really a wonderful building. When they're showing it here, it's towards the end of its life, and the balcony and a lot of the ornamentation is gone. But that was, you know, one of our original buildings sold to William Ryan in about 1874 by George Robbins. So essentially the building that is there now is only the second building to be in that spot. And to the backside, there's a newspaper article from 1936 showing that the old Ryan Hotel is to be demolished, and that the new building will be a new modern building will be built in its place. And the next page has two photos that show the arches pretty much as they remain today. And those are probably both in the late 30s. And the next page, on the back side, there's an article from 1937 talking about how the former Ryan Hotel site, there's a one-story structure of stucco finish with an arcade extending out over the sidewalk. It will be a grocery store and a drugstore. And then the last page shows an advertisement for the Arcade Grocery. And you notice that they included arcade in their name. I think that arcade was like the new modern look, and they were trying to, you know, incorporate that into the name. So anyway, the bottom line is I think that I conclude that this probably is historic because of all the information that we collected in addition to what Page and Turnbull did. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you for the information. Okay, at this time we're going to come back to the council. Any questions or clarifications on the staff report? Okay, why don't we start with Councilmember Guthrie, and then we'll go to Councilmember Brown and to my left. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. I'm just following up on our conversation from earlier this afternoon and wondering specifically how agricultural, it refers to agricultural lands becoming, being an historic resource as well. And I'm just wondering if you can elaborate on how that would work.
I did talk to the city attorney about this earlier. So it does identify agriculture is obviously an important theme throughout the city's history. But as far as, and there may be portions that can be preserved or designated case-by-case basis, but as far as taking an active agricultural field that's being farmed and designating that whole thing, I'll let Tim jump in if he'd like with his explanation.
It's a great question. I know under our criteria, if it's a site of significant local, county, state, or national historic event, that qualifies. My question back to you is, did you intend to designate the entire, you're talking about like an agricultural field in this case?
Well, that was my question. It refers to small farms were an essential part of our agricultural history, and therefore, in the way I would read it, small farms could be designated as historic. Small farms would include farmland. I could certainly see how a homestead or those kinds of things would fit, but I wanted to see specifically what I was asking is how small farm would fit an historic designation.
And I think you could designate a small farm historic. The question is, in doing so, do you intend to preserve it in its natural state? Because it raises a lot of interesting legal issues. Takings would be the most predominant of them. So I don't have a good answer for you. I think it's a question that's probably going to come up at some point in our history here, and we'll have to struggle with the designation process itself and then what that really means, whether it means preserving it, identifying it, through some other embodiment preserving it through, you know, a museum, a plaque. I mean, there's ways of preserving sites without necessarily leaving them in their natural state forever. Because I think conventionally, for instance, the federal government, some of the Civil War sites in the South, they've been designated historic. A lot of them, they're purchased. If the intention is to preserve them in their natural state, they're purchased by the government because of this takings issue, because you really can't create open space through the designation process. But you can designate something, including a small farm, a field. We have one on East Cherry that probably has some historical overtones that are going to come up in the context of its development. And that's actually been, I think, talked about in terms of some form of museum or garden to preserve its historical nature without necessarily preserving the entire site, but sort of looking through our own local regulations, I think you can designate something historic without necessarily preserving it forever, the entirety of it forever. And I think you can probably make findings under our own local regulations that would allow you to do so. You know, the bigger issue to me are you actually saying, let's designate, say a historic strawberry field as historic and then attempting to preserve it so that essentially it can never be developed out of that state, because that does raise some obvious legal issues that we'll struggle with when we get to that point. But rather than Babylon, do you want to be real specific as in terms?
Well, I just wonder how that, because the way it reads in here, it sounds as if we could designate that. I understand what you're saying, we could designate it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we are going to preserve in the same sense that we'd be asking to preserve a building.
I think that was my point. Certainly you can designate something historic and not freeze it in that state forever. You know, a large 20-acre tract of farmland, it would be tough to designate it historic, essentially creating open space without purchasing it, because the owner's going to say, what have you done to me? So I think the answer is you can certainly do so. The question is, how are you going to preserve its historical nature, through some record or through physical preservation?
Thank you, Ben. And the second question, which you actually answered for me, and that had to do with the cost of the historic surveys. I know there's been a reference here that possibly we could do them with the committee, but just that the cost of doing those historic surveys was about $3,700 for all 25 of them?
From what I could tell looking at the contract, that's how they broke it out, hours and cost-wise was about $3,700.
Thank you. Those are my good questions.
Okay. Councilmember Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Something you brought up in your report, Ryan, is something I struggled with, and I talked to Steve about it just briefly via email, and that is I'm a little concerned going forward about how the document might box us in terms of whether something's historic or not. And so here's my question. You have a certified local government designation. Assuming we have that designation, which we don't have yet, would we be in a better stead to make our own independent judgment versus an expert that we hire to make that same determination?
I think it's maybe a two-part question, so I'll try to answer them separately. The first issue with the getting boxed in with the context statement, again, the context statement is purely meant to be informational, so it kind of provides our jumping-off point for evaluation of historic resources. We still do have our findings in 1616.135 that would have to be met to make any designation of resource or district, that those findings could be tied to the content of the context statement, which is what it's intended to. But there's always the possibility that there's something that's not currently in the context statement that comes to light that could be tied to those findings. I guess vice versa, there could be something that's in the context statement that additional information at some point in the future could maybe contradict. I don't know. I think we did a pretty thorough job of getting it to where it's at today. So it's not the only informational source that we have to rely on to make those findings for designation. Getting to the question of the certified local government, I think it seems like we already do a lot of the requirements to be a certified local government, and that's basically we have to implement in good faith the policies of the OHP. The one significant change would be going from a historical resources committee to a historical resources commission, and there's certain membership requirements for that commission. The intention is that commission would have one or two qualified professionals that sit on that body that would then help and assist with the evaluations. So it does provide added flexibility. It also would allow us to seek funding for historic preservation efforts. Just as an example, it's my understanding that San Luis has had their historic preservation program since the late 80s, and they only recently became a certified local government, and they've never had a context statement, and they're in the process of adopting a context statement now with money that they received through a grant because they're a certified local government. So I think it does give flexibility when you're talking about going out and doing in-house evaluations, but you do have to meet those minimum standards of qualifications for the people that sit on that commission.
But it would seem like if we want the chance to dispute what the expert said, we need to have that in place to even be able to do that.
Disputing what the expert said, I think it's is Shirley explained with her presentation. I don't know that we're going to butt heads on it. I think if they had access to more information or more information was provided to them, they may very well come to the same conclusion as the HRC. I think it was just a matter of them not having a complete record for some of these properties that they surveyed.
So the properties that were left off, in theory, the HRC or some private party could come forward with more information, and then who would make the determination that it goes on that list or doesn't go on the list? The expert or the council, or who would do that?
If you're talking, well, locally, it would be the council would be the ultimate arbitrator of whether it's locally designated or not. If you're talking the 523 forms, if we are certified local government, the city could prepare those forms and submit them for inclusion into the statewide database, or the consultant or a different consultant could essentially start from scratch. We didn't want to get into the position of changing the conclusion on the survey when it was prepared by somebody else and then submitting that on. It's not their work. It's the HRC's opinion rather than the consultant's professional opinion. But I think in moving forward with these particular five properties, if we're able to provide a more complete record, that in and of itself may change their conclusion, whether it's Page and Turnbull or whether it's we hand off to a new consultant at some point in the future to reevaluate those five properties.
But we're still going to have to involve a consultant even if we're a certified local government.
No, I think if we're a certified local government, we could do those in-house, assuming we get certified, because that means that we have, I think it's at least two people on our commission that would be qualified to conduct those surveys.
Okay. And then the other question is about the Mills Act. It would seem to me that that's, you know, part and parcel of what we're trying to do here. So in terms of priority, is that hard to do? Is it time-consuming? What's the timeline for something like that?
I think it would just mainly consume staff time, and I would say a ballpark on that would probably be at least 6 months. And part of that is we'd want to work closely with the HRC to establish that ordinance, and meeting only once a month, you can only get so much done. So that in and of itself kind of stretches out that timeline.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Councilmember Ray.
Okay. Ryan, first of all, with the regard to being a certified local government, is there any kind of annual cost to the city that comes with that? I didn't see any discussion of any financial issues there.
Not that I'm aware of. Not that's come up in any previous discussion of the process.
Okay. There's... I'm confused on... Well, it's page 177, but let me go there. It's page 71 of item 9A, and it's page 56 of the document. And there's a discussion of what I'll call the malt shop. And I'm confused as to why we're including that as a statement of historical significance, even though this council determined that it wasn't. Can you explain why that's there in the way that it's described?
That particular statement was added by the Historical Resources Committee, and I think the intent was they felt even though it was no longer extant, it was an example of that particular vernacular. So that's something that wasn't part of the original draft. It was added by the HRC.
We can't hear you, Gary, when you talk from the audience. And hang on just a second. Let Ryan finish.
I'm finished. If I'm mistaken, I'll let Gary jump in.
No, I just wanted to say that to correct Ryan on that, it wasn't their original report. They did talk about that. We modified the wording of it. I think we actually softened it a bit.
I apologize for the mistake. I looked at it right before the meeting started in the red line draft and saw that it was underlined, so I just assumed that it had been added, but I'll go to modified. Okay.
Gary, would you mind telling you got to come up here, though. Tell me what it used to say? More or less? I mean, how did you soften that? I'm just curious. Because the wording here says how important it is, but the council deemed that it wasn't. So I'm trying to reconcile what the difference is here.
I don't remember what the original wording was, and that we softened it wasn't that big a deal. But I think what the point is that it was the consultant who somehow found that building and put it in there, not us. And I know I argued very strongly to in favor of that building, so I probably look a little strange here. But we just modified it. That's all we did. It was in the consultant's report. And
okay, all
right. I don't know how the consultant got it into their report.
Okay, thank you. And then just real quick, there's a reference to Andranini's coffee shop. We might want to fix that. There are also several blank pages kind of where it breaks in the middle of a paragraph. And I don't know if that's just a typo, if there's something else that it's being left room, so something's going to be added there or something. There's two pages where that happens. Are there visuals that are supposed to go in there, or is that just a funky printing thing?
Do you have the page numbers? I think the breaks occur because there's either an illustration or a map on the following page. If I remember, there's a couple of those. And then I know there's a bunch of blank pages as you get toward the back with the appendices. And that's just the way that it was formatted from the consultant.
Hang on, let me see if I can reference it. Well, maybe I'm insane because I can't find it now, but maybe it's just the way my thing rendered it, or I don't know what. Okay. There's discussion
of on page 63 about the significance of civic and institutional buildings, and specifically it talks about schools. And I'm just confused as to what our authority is on designating whether or not things that belong to the school district as historic, and whether we have any jurisdiction over that, because they tend to be a kind of a separate entity from the city with its own separate legal codes and statutes and thing that it follows. So can you just let me know how that works there? About there's some discussion of Paulding and Margaret Harlow and whether or not those buildings may be historic.
I guess I would defer to Tim on the legality of it, but I would think that we can designate it. And I know this is a little different because it's a private school, but the Valley View Adventist Academy came forward recently. Well, it's been a few years now with a proposal to remodel one of their buildings, and the HRC felt that it was potentially historic. So the school, instead of kind of fighting that, just went ahead and remodeled it according to the Secretary of Interior standards to retain that historic integrity of that particular building. But I'll let
It's the public school aspect
Tim
that I have the question about.
Augment my answer.
I don't know. Excuse me again. I don't know of any regulation that would deprive us of the opportunity to designate it like any other property. The difference being the state's the owner. If they were not willing to do so, it would go through the process, the planning commission and council process, as any property that the owner objected to the designation.
The reason I'm asking, and maybe you can correct me, maybe there is a difference. I can remember when we were looking at the properties down on near the athletic field and the bus barn, and basically the way that it came to us was they asked for our blessing, but they didn't really have to do that because they had the latitude to do whatever they wanted on their grounds. So if we designate that historic, isn't that just us saying, hey, pretty please don't do something to this building? Or does that work like any other property owner coming in?
Well, it means that if they ever came forward with any modification, they'd be subject to the same CEQA analysis, the same mitigation as a result of the historic designation as any other property. And I don't think the fact that it's owned by the state, I mean, obviously they have different powers, but in terms of our ability to make that designation, I'm not sure there's anything that would inhibit our ability to do so.
Okay.
I'll just add, just hopefully for a clarification, if there's a building permit being sought for a school building, a public school building, that goes through the state, and we don't have jurisdiction over that.
Okay.
This would be a different, this would be treated as if we were suggesting a local designation, for example, we could do so as long as the certain criteria are met, which are outlined in this report.
So then if the school district wanted to, for example, I'm not suggesting the school district wants to do anything, it's just for sake of argument, but let's say they wanted to demolish and re-permit, but then they get to skip over us. How does that work?
Well, let me jump in here for a second. I'm fairly certain, based on the fact that I spent a good deal of time working with them, excuse me, that we would be trumped here, and we would be trumped by the Division of the State Architect. And the Division of the State Architect makes determinations on, number one, historic designations, but more importantly, older schools that we might look upon as historic still have to be subject to rigorous building code, seismic retrofitting, all of those kinds of things. And by the time they go through all of that, if we were to apply our local criteria, I think we would find that it no longer applies. But I'm fairly certain that any historic designation, regardless of whether it's local or regional or the state, would have to go through the Division of the State Architect. They would, if we were dealing with Lushimar, they would intervene, and they would intervene quickly in something like that. So I think our discussion would take place from someone from that department.
That was what I thought the answer was. So
I think my only caveat is even the state architect has to comply with CEQA. That's where you're going to find this. Okay. You know, it all catches up when you have to mitigate impacts to resources. Historical resources are environmental resources.
Okay.
So you're still going to have to play the game. I agree that they'll erode it away until there's probably not a whole lot left.
Okay.
And but yeah, you can designate, and it's going to have some impact on the project overall down the line.
It'll at least get discussed and fleshed out. Okay, great. Thank you. That's all for now. Thank you.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I've got a quick question. I'm not sure who can answer it. In terms of the Mills Act, it talks about that being an economic benefit to the property owner, and yet it says that it's about $500 a piece of property, the difference to the city. That doesn't seem like much of an economic advantage to a property owner. Is there something else in the Mills Act that makes this appealing to a property owner to seek this?
That number is from the city of San Luis Obispo. I think the number that the property owner receives in benefit is much higher than that, but that was the city's cost for that reduction. I think the school district also sees reduction and the county. So it could be
so it's more significant.
More than $500. And, you know, depending on how the Mills Act ordinance would be structured, you know, some property owners over time, and I know Gary is probably more qualified to speak on this than I am because he has more experience with it, but there is an economic benefit with sort of a critical mass of these historic structures that becomes a vibrant area and people want to move there and the rents increase and so on and so forth.
And that's all I have for now.
Okay. If I can just add, the actual benefit to the property owner is more on the level of they estimate between 40 and 60% savings on property taxes. It's just our allocation of that tax is really small. That's why the number you see is only $500.
Okay.
School districts and other levels of government also have a big share of that tax that's reduced.
Thank you.
I had just a couple of quick questions, Ryan. First of all, we obviously have some additional research that was turned in and address this evening, and I guess my question is, if we were to move forward with an action on this evening, would it be assumed that we would take another look at some of the additional information, dates, and some of the blocks that were marked unknown? Now we may have additional information that fills those information fields. So is that the process that we assume would happen?
You're speaking towards the building record?
Right.
Yeah, we can definitely take that and any additional information that Shirley or anybody else would have for the other four properties and move on with that. As I said, we could either go back to the original consultant, have a new consultant, or any number of options. But tonight's action would still have those set aside. We don't need to make a determination on those five because, again, it's the without the benefit of the consultant reviewing all of that information that was made available to the council and reaching their own conclusion, we can't just arbitrarily jump in and change boxes and then submit it as if it was the work of the consultant.
No, I'm just saying if there's a way that we can make sure that as we move forward and formalize this report that that it has the most current and accurate information in it. So that's all. Some way to do that.
Yes, and I think that's one of the recommendations is to continue looking at designations. I just want to take a second here to, you know, Ryan's alluded to the amount of work that's gone into this document before you by our HRC committee, an enormous amount of hours that they've put in poring over, you know, drafts of this context statement and the suggested designations, and so we got so far along in this document. It will continue to be modified by additional designations, I presume, in the future, or surveys conducted in the future, and an evolving document as we go forward. And information such as this can be, you know, brought forward and passed to the surveyor or a different surveyor, as Ryan said, but. I would just advise that you look at this document as something that will probably grow over time. And we just kind of
to picked a stopping point because the complete nature of the context statement in itself, and we are out of consultant money to bring it forward to you tonight without taking an additional, you know, maybe substantial amount of time it may take to resolve the issues on these five properties.
Okay, thanks. I had one last question, and actually it was the same question that Councilmember Guthrie asked. With regard to the small farm designation, and you know, I kind of want to just share a scenario. You guys tell me if you know it makes sense or not. But if we were to look at a farm operation or a small farm, which might include a barn, might include a farmhouse, if we were to apply the same criteria that we would normally apply to some evaluation of a historic structure, if it met that criteria, if it was in fact a significant site, something important happened there, the architecture, whatever the case may be, that designation might take place on the structure. But as far as the land is concerned, it would seem to me that a more appropriate approach to that would be to allow it to fall under our land use element and our ag protection policies if we were going to maybe steer clear of the challenges that you spoke of. Is that a scenario that we might utilize or approach in this instead of designating the farmland as itself?
Well, unfortunately, I think then it falls back on the characterization of the soil itself. Because our ag element, as you know, prime ag soil, class 1 and 2, are what are protected. And, you know, let's just say for purposes of this discussion, it was class 4. We'd probably be fumbling around trying to use, to a certain extent, this method to sort of gain the same byproduct, which is preservation. But I think that's the first approach is certainly let's use our land use structure as it is now and not delve into this. I think it's going to be a combination if it's a farm like that. But I think that because that's so narrow in really designating only certain types of soil subject to the requirements, it may not always apply.
I'm just thinking of
– Oh, no, I love
Mills
the approach.
We got the Williamson Act, so you know, where do we go?
The approach is a far better legal approach for me, but I think there's going to be ones that don't fit neatly into either category.
Okay.
Tony,
okay, you had another one?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I got distracted, and then I ended up finding that page break I was talking about, which is on page 55, because that's the other question that I skipped. With regard to the post-war era and beyond, there's discussion of the car culture and commercial development, and the document goes on to talk about why strip malls developed the way they did, with the windows in the way that they did, with the parking the way that they did. And it could be argued that that frames an argument for making strip malls historic buildings. And yet we have portions of our general plan that are designed to change the way that we've done that kind of development. So that's in direct conflict with our general plan. Can you comment on that?
Well, I think any property is going to be evaluated in light of CEQA, and just because there may be a strip mall, we'd have to look at the context and other factors to determine whether that in and of itself is historic or if it's not. But there certainly can be aspects of that which could be historic given the right setting, but that I would say it's going to be a case-by-case determination on each property.
I'm just going to call a spade here and say that a really great representation of a strip mall is probably not something we'd like to designate historic, even though it is a perfect representation of that time period. I have fear about that. I guess I'll just leave that to the council to consider as we go forward with the discussion. The second thing is, in that same vein, there's discussion about a lot of the development that happened in the 50s and the 60s with the ranch style, you know, that used to have one of those down on Turquoise, and it's a great little house. And the idea that in and of itself, it's probably not historic, but an entire district could be deemed historic out of that. And again, I don't necessarily want to suggest that I'm not for historic designations. I'm a history teacher, for goodness sake. But the way that this it's such a broad brush that it seems that with this document, it could be argued by anyone coming forward, not necessarily us and what we want, but anybody coming forward, that any building in the city could be historic. So, can you help me put that in a box that I can swallow?
I would keep in mind that this context statement includes general themes, how things were settled, the patterns of development, and certainly we wouldn't want to be in a position where we're kind of gleaning the attractive parts and not, keeping the authentic development patterns adequately documented in this context statement. But be that as it may, I think that development patterns aside, the criteria are pretty specific on how to designate a property. And so we'd find ourselves necessarily obligated to designate something based on just a description on the unsettlement patterns in and of themselves.
Okay. Thank you. That really is the last of it. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions?
Just ask one real quick, because there's this next step, this actual designation step. What's the kind of time pattern? Look, I'm certainly one of the things that we don't like to see is when these come up as part of a project. And so what is we file this and we become a certified city and all those things. What's then the next step that actually trips the notice to the owner that says we're considering designation of your property? Is that something that we do from the dais, or is that something that comes out of HRC?
The initiation can come from property owners themselves on a voluntary basis, or it can originate with the HRC. And at that time, it would set in motion that process outlined in 16-16-135, where the property owner is notified and we make the determination. It's structured in a way that if it's a voluntary designation, it's basically an administrative approval by the community development director. If it's something that's initiated outside of the property owner's consent, then it goes to public hearing to the planning commission and could conceivably be appealed to the council for a decision on designation. We've talked at the HRC with the upcoming work plan, identifying some properties that might be candidates for designation, and those would originate with the HRC. Some properties are city-owned properties, so those may be the easiest to start with, because we conceivably have property owner consent, and we could just designate those to kind of get the ball rolling. But there's also the option that it could be discovered or initiated when a project is proposed on a particular property, that something comes up and it's flagged that it could meet that criteria, and then the committee, as part of their review process, could initiate designation, and then it would go from there.
So our action tonight doesn't actually start the designation process itself. It simply puts
it just lays the foundation, but it would still be, like I said, individual property owners or HRC to initiate those individual properties for designation. One thing that is on the work program for the upcoming year is looking at the establishment of a historic district. So I know that's something that the HRC is wanting to get done sooner rather than later.
All right. I know several of you have already spoken, but we're now formally going to move to the public hearing portion of this item. So if there's anyone else who would like to come forward during the public hearing portion, this would be an opportunity. Minetta, you might have to pull that mic boom down there a little bit there.
I'll see. Okay. How's that?
Good.
Is that all right? I'm Minetta Bennett. I live at 415 Allen Street, Arroyo Grande. And I'm not very good at public speaking. I just want to say I would like our property put in this, in a reserve like this. Oh, before I forget it, you talk about farms. I want to mention that the Dixon Ranch out here on East Cherry Avenue is already in a federal, state, whatever. It's already put in a preserve, so it will stay a farm. Anyway, back to my building on 122 East Branch. It is now Gather Wine Bar. I would like it put into this context, and I would like this context to be passed. And also, I will say, Bill Hart was at my house not too long ago, about a month ago, and he did say that our building is one of the best preserved in the village. We have all of the old shelves. Our lease agreement protects the property inside. They cannot deface. They cannot take the old shelves down. And our present lease even puts it in that they cannot move the safe. They cannot cover the elevator. It has to stay the way it is. And if I had to, we could probably recreate the scene of the building when it's been in my husband's family since 1903. And we could recreate that whole interior if we wanted to, because we have all of the fixtures and things. So I think we need this context for the village. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments.
Thank you for listening.
You're welcome. Anyone else?
I'm Gary Shirkquist again. I wanted to respond to a couple of things I think that Councilwoman Ray brought up. Proper way of addressing you, Councilwoman. I'm sorry. Anyway, one of the things that we don't have, which is from a preservationist point of view, is a wonderful thing, but most cities have a time frame, and then 50 years kind of is the standard. Some have 40. I think Ventura has 40 years. It causes you not to look at things that are new and decide whether they're historic or not. That sometimes has gotten around if it's a fantastic piece of architecture, but normally something has to be there for 50 years so you have the judgment of time and the perspective of time and history before you judge it. Now, I know that tract house you were talking about is already 50 years old, but...
It's historic because I lived there, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, it may not be historic. I mean, just because something's old doesn't mean it has any historic value. I don't know. I mean, sometimes I haven't been to your house.
Do you mind if I ask you real quickly,
sure.
Why don't we have that portion? You said that we don't have that 50 years designation.
Right.
Why is that?
I didn't write the ordinance.
Okay.
I'm happy that it's not there, but that's okay. Anyway, on farmland, I just can't conceive of designating an entire 500 acres as being historic, and you can't do anything with it. I agree with what the mayor said and Tim Carmel said about designating the building and maybe putting up a plaque or something, but I don't think this HRC is going to be any problem for you on that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
Bill Hart, again, you do have a process for designating historical resources, and Mrs. Bennett just offered her property. And I'm going to make a suggestion, since that process is already in there is a small fee that is presented for those who come. I think it's a couple hundred dollars if you ask to have your property designated. And I would suggest that maybe to get things rolling, I would that fee gets waived for a couple of months for people so that we could have some properties designated in here in the village and the business district in particular. I don't know if that appeals to you or not, but I think that would be a very wonderful thing to do to get those people who are interested in it that would like to have their properties designated, that the fee is waived, not forever, just for a few months. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else?
Shirley Gibson again. I just wanted to say, you know, it's a little bit intimidating when you hire the experts and then after working with them, you know, that they did a good job, but you really realize that we have a lot of expertise and knowledge and, you know, I think a lot more confidence in, you know, trying to get through this process. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, we will close the public hearing portion of this item and bring this back to the council. And we will start to my left with Councilmember Ray.
I was hoping you'd start here because I really wanted to say something nice here. Anybody who's been paying attention to the HRC agendas over the last few years, they've had one thing on that darn agenda, and that's this. And it's over and over and over again. And that, as anybody who serves on one of these committees knows, that's not the only work that went into that. That was hours and hours and hours of prep to get to that meeting to deal with the same thing over and over and over again. And so first of all, I wanted to say thank you. And the fact that there are so many people here from the HRC in support of it late at night, thank you for coming out here. And I want to make sure that I say, and it's important to say the words, that any criticism of the document or any little pieces inside, please don't take that as any form of disrespect or lack of support for you or your work that you've done. Thank you so much for that. So I asked some tough questions, and I think they were important to ask, but I'm satisfied with what I heard tonight, and I like the idea that this is a living document and is treated as such, because as was so importantly just said, we can pay those people to write a really nice report, but they don't know us. We know us. And so that we can go back and deal with that as we can is great. I find the suggestion about a temporary fee waiver interesting in the same way that we did the sort of an amnesty for the sign program. I like it. On first glance, I'm looking forward to hearing what the rest of the council has to say. I've given it precisely 3 minutes of thought. But it's consistent with what we've done before, and it may get that ball rolling, so I would be open to hearing about that. And I'll just close by saying I'm in support tonight, and again, thank you so much for the – I don't think anybody but they will ever know how much work went into putting that document together. So thanks. That's all.
Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I concur with her comments about the HRC as well, so I won't add any more to that. I'm in support of the document if we can, in the same breath, say that we're going to pursue a certified local government status, because I think that's part and parcel of what we need to do to make this actually a functioning, living document. Without that, I have some real trepidation about an outside expert having the ultimate say over whether a building is historic or not. The other thing that gives me a little bit of pause, and I just want to put out for food for thought, is when Ryan talked about the idea that some of these buildings are going to get flagged during the development process or when they come before the council. And we've just spent quite a bit of time, I think, trying to tell the local business community that we were trying to streamline regulations so that they could move forward quickly and know what they were getting into. And I totally understand the nature of what Ryan's saying. I don't disagree with what he's saying, but what I'm curious about is what happens if that scenario takes place. How long is the applicant going to have to wait to get a determination one way or the other so that they can move forward? That makes me nervous. And I just say that as a informational issue. I think it's something we need to flesh out. I think the public has a right to know what they're getting into. In the same way that I think the community at large has a right to protect those resources that we believe are valuable, but it needs to be fair on both ends. So that's the part I'm concerned about. Having said that, I am in support of moving forward. I agree with the mayor's comment regarding the soils issue. I think we have another part of our general plan that really deals with that. And while I understand it in the context of the document, I think there's a better place to deal with those issues. And that's the direction I would be looking if we ever ran into that issue. So those are my comments, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Any comments? Councilmember Ray raised the issue of the fees. Any comments on that?
I'm all for it. I think it's a great idea. And I think Mrs. Bennett should be given the help that she needs to walk through the process, because it's new for them as well. So whatever you can do to make the process easier for her, whether it's fees or whether it's just the process, what do I need to do next? What paperwork needs to be done? What do I need to do? She's graciously volunteered herself up as an example of how this is supposed to work, and I think we need to help her get through that process.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Guthrie.
Yep. I, too, will start by recognizing really the two and a half years of work that really went into putting together this document and all of the extra work that you guys have put into it. All right, I'll move closer. Can you hear me now? All right. So I too want to do that. I do want to also echo, though, that it is a very broad brush, and the proof for the pudding will be in when we actually go through the designation process on the individual properties. I am particularly concerned about them coming up in the middle of a development. You know, that's the way they've come up in the past, and that's not the right way to make this kind of a decision. And I do share some of the concerns that because it's such a broad brush, I just point out that I don't think a single one of these properties was not recommended for designation because it didn't qualify, except for that it had too many modifications. And in the way that I read the various reviews, they all had the caveat at the end was does not qualify because it's had too many alterations to meet its original state. The one exception would be the one that actually HRC has recommended changing from a designated property to an undesignated property would be the one exception to that if that in fact takes place. I think this sentence here, it reads in almost all of them, it says, is however locally significant both as an individually eligible resource and contributor to potential historic district under national and California register criteria A. So they all refer back to what I believe is this designated district and its and the way that it fits into its character. So the way I see this going forward, certainly we want to do all of the things that staff has recommended, which is the Mills Act and the certification. All of those things really need to take place. I think in addition to that, I'd like to see staff has recommended that we try to do another 25 of these a year. That's the reason I asked about the price of it, and I understand that once we got certification, we could do this in-house. But I think we probably want to move forward a little more quickly than that, particularly with anywhere we think there might be a potential project or significant change, and have more of these in place so that more is known up front before projects come forward. If they really can be done for a couple $100 a piece, then, and particularly with the support of the additional information maybe given up front or a review of them and we have something of a back and forth, then we can probably get through, we can probably find $5,000 or $10,000 to get through a whole bunch of these in a hurry. That would be my recommendation. I can support the waiving of the fee. Well, the bottom line is I can support going forward with a contact statement. I do also want to add that my concern about Agland wasn't that I really was suggesting that we were going to designate Agland historic. I'm just going to say that any time one of those processes took place, this would come up as well, and that we need to be prepared to deal with whatever it is. And, you know, at some point we will be dealing with some Agland that does get converted. And here's just an additional sort of jamming up the works with this historical designation that we need to deal with as well. So That was my concern when I read this, that I just didn't see how you could make that kind of a designation. But I do understand you can make the designation without necessarily freezing the property. So with that, I do think we want to go forward with probably more of these reviews sooner than later. I do think waiving the fee is a good idea if we put a time limit on it. If you come forward before this time, then we'll waive the fee. I suspect that the fee is based on some sort of expense. I don't know if we have to do one of these reviews for anyone who has to be designated or not. That is going to be a cost to the city, something that I think we might consider when we bring it back. But depending on what the cost to the city is, it certainly is in our economic development interests to make sure that these kinds of issues are fleshed out early rather than late. So I can support going forward with the designation, doing the submittals, and all of the other processes that will allow us to make this an easier process, because that's always been my concern from the beginning, to make this a good and fair and as quick as possible a process. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'd also like to start off by thanking the volunteers we have in the HRC and the Planning Commission for the work they've done on this. And you are volunteers. You put a lot of time in, and we really appreciate that you did this. Then I'd like to just address, first of all, I'll say I'm going to support this tonight. What we're looking at is adopting a resolution to adopt the historical context statement. And there's four parts to that. But the point of this is to have and I'll quote here, an adopted CY's historical context statement, because it's going to serve as the basis for a systematic evaluation of city's historical resources. It's an adopted historical context statement that will inform and ensure consistency in future historic resource preservation efforts throughout the city. And that's what we're trying to do. We're coming up with a context statement that will make this a process that will be dependable, that we can count on and look forward to. So I initially had some trepidation about a series of 25 pieces of property that we had conflict on five of them. In discussion with staff, I've come to understand that there's a reason for that conflict and that it's not necessarily a bad thing, and it's just something we'll take a better look at with more information. But the essential thing is to have the adopted historical context statement in place. So I will support this tonight. I'll support the 4 points of directing staff to submit the survey findings of the 20 pieces of property, pursuing the status of certified local government, begin to work on a Mills Act ordinance, and continuing to conduct historical resource analysis surveys. And that's something we'll get through in through time. And I will support the temporary lifting of the fee for anyone that wants to come forward. I think that's a great idea. And we'll put that in for, 3, 6 months, whatever, and go forward with that. And I think that this is a step we need to be taking, and I'm very happy to support it tonight.
Okay, thank you. Well, one of the good things about going last is that everyone has already said everything that I want to say. So, but I did want to point out the fact that I think several years ago, Steve, our city manager, and I sat down and sort of discussed the concept of what a Historic Resources Commission would do if we were to form one. And I think Steve was the first one to describe sort of a scope of work, if you will. And this was a large part of it. And I don't think at that time any of us envisioned the amount of work that would have to go into it. But we certainly, as my colleagues have all indicated, we certainly recognize and appreciate what you've done. It's, I think exceeded any of our expectations in terms of your ability to grasp this and move forward with it. So I'm not going to add much more to the discussion tonight. We've had a very good in-depth discussion. I will support this, and I will also support the, once again, what Councilmember Ray recommended, which was a waiver of the fees for a designated period of time, and perhaps when we make a motion here, we can specify what that time is, so that staff will understand it. And with that, we do have a recommendation. We have a resolution to adopt, and as the Mayor Pro Tem indicated, we also have direction to staff here. So I'll entertain a motion at this time.
I'll move a resolution of the City Council of the City of Rio Grande adopting a historic context statement, staff project 12-005.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Was that you, Mr. Costello? Right. Mr. Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Ray?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay, we need another motion.
I move also that we recommend that we recommend to staff that they submit the survey findings for 20 historic recordation forms, pursue the status as a certified local government, and begin work on the Mills Act ordinance, and continue to conduct historic surveys. My recommendation on this particular part is that we have staff come back with what they believe would be a cost to do, say, 50 or 100 of them. I mean, you know, moving forward much more quickly than that's my recommendation. But that we see what that actual cost would be, and that we have staff bring back a proposal to waive the fee. I believe we're going to have to talk about a year in order to make it reasonable. 3 to 6 months would barely get somebody through the submittal process if they started tomorrow. So I'm going to say a year would be my recommendation here.
All right. We have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
And a second. Discussion. Okay. No discussion. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Ray?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. Okay. Teresa, before you leave.
Did want to add, several of the committee members mentioned it, but this is kind of a momentous evening because this is Ryan's last council meeting, so we want to wish him the best and all the appreciation for all the good work he's done. He started a little bit before I did, so he's been here about 13 years, right?
13 years last Monday.
Started as an intern and worked his way up. So.
Thanks, Ryan.
Well, Ryan, it's been a pleasure having you aboard, and I don't think any of us have anything negative to say about the reports that you've brought in front of us. They've been clear, concise, and made it easy for us to make a decision. So we appreciate all that you've done for the city, and we're going to miss you. So,
I really enjoyed the last 13 years, and I was telling Jim the other day that one of my first memories of working here as an intern was the midnight meetings with the 2001 general plan update. So it's wasn't looking to leave, but it was an opportunity that I couldn't pass up.
Right. Well, good luck to you. Anyone else?
Thank you.
Okay.
I remember those meetings as well, and I remember you being there.
Okay. All right, we're going to move on to the next item. And this is 11A, process for weed abatement and sale of fireworks. Good evening, Chief.
It's hard to follow that, isn't it? Pardon? It's hard to follow that, isn't it?
It is. You've spent a considerable amount of time preserving history, and I'm going to ask you to change a part of it now. As you all know, Joel Arenas, Five Cities Fire Authority. As you all know, the reason you formed the authority was to increase the efficiencies of the fire service and to increase the service provided by that service. one of the things that we're faced with is with weed abatement and with fireworks sales are three sets of rules in three different entities, all administered by the fire authority. So we have we'll start with weed abatement. We have, let's say, a property owner here in the city of Arroyo Grande, maybe owns property in Oceano, maybe owns property in Grover Beach. He has three different sets of rules to follow. He has three different public hearings to attend, three different mow-down deadlines, three different protest hearings to attend to. And it's just not a very efficient system as far as government goes. We think we can streamline it and possibly make it a little more efficient for everybody involved. And the same thing with fireworks. The groups that staff the booths have different dates and different meetings to go to and different times according to the ordinances, depending on which community they have their booth in. And again, it's all administered by the fire authority. It makes it difficult for us to do all three different entities and three different sets of dates. We have people that can stand on one side of the street and say, why do I have to have my weeds down by this date? And that person across the street does not. Is the weather any different? Are the weeds any drier on this side of the street than they are on the other side of the street? And, of course, the answer is no. It's just how the process has been set up over the years by the three different entities. So what we're asking the three different agencies that the authority provides protection for is to consider the standardization of these processes. If you've had a chance to look at the matrices in the back of the report, you can see what currently is your practice in the city of Arroyo Grande and what we're proposing to change it to. You can see that there are some things that will not change for your city, and you can see that there are things that will change. I'm sure I read someplace recently that good government requires debate and good government requires, I lost the term. It's terrible to get old.
Compromise,
thank you. So what I'm asking is that you can see your way to compromise on some of these things, most notably, I think, for the city of Arroyo Grande with the sales of fireworks, is that the times that we're asking the booths to stay open is going to change by an hour. The times that fireworks can be set off will change by a couple of days. Right now, you can only set off fireworks in Arroyo Grande on July 4th. That would change from, I think, noon on July 3rd till midnight on July 5th. But really, in looking at the amount of fireworks that are set off other than the 4th of July is really a small amount. We don't think that's going to be much of a problem. And as far as weed abatement, again, we can take all of that off of your plate, if you will, and put it all with the authority, streamline the process, and hopefully make it a little bit easier for everybody. So with this process, if you agree to the standardization, then I'm going to carry this same message to the Oceano Community Services District tomorrow night and to Grover Beach City Council on the 19th. Once everybody agrees, or if they do agree, then we will approach or have our legal counsel draft an ordinance for weed abatement and for fireworks, and then share that with your legal counsel to change your ordinances to look essentially like ours, or your process will mirror ours, and we will just have the one process. So again, if you do agree to it, this really is the first step. I think we have a 30-day waiting period, and these will not be in place for weed abatement this year. They will not be in place for fireworks this year, but they will be in place for the season coming up in 14.
Okay. Any questions for the chief? I do have one quick question on the extension of time for the discharge of fireworks. That's additional time than we're accustomed to here.
Correct.
I know that before the fire authority was formed, when we first legalized fireworks in the city, there was a good deal of concern about the safety and the fire threat and all of that.
Yes.
And I think that was one of the reasons why we narrowed that time frame for the discharge of fireworks. The other thing that it required, obviously, was a good deal of, at that time, department time on neighborhood patrols and that sort of thing to ensure that, you know, safety measures were being taken. Has some of that anxiety died down because now we're extending the period out, and which is going to require more vigilance on the part of the fire authority? So I'm assuming that's okay with you guys. So.
Yes, I understand everything that you went through in my previous life. Fireworks had been illegal in the city of Fresno, I think, since 1928, and with the millennium, they wanted to make them legal. And, of course, we had a lot of concern about that. But in the 12 years that have transpired since then, our problem is not with safe and sane fireworks. Our problem is with the illegal fireworks that come in from out of state, the things that leave the ground and explode and that sort of thing. And those are the issues that we have as far as fire safety, not safe and sane.
Okay. Very good. This is... Did you have a question? Go ahead.
Yeah, my question is, and it may be in here and I'm dismissing it, but it doesn't list anywhere the number of booths that are going to be allowed or the process by which you pick them. I mean, we have generally have more requests than we have slots and have had a rotation in place. But I don't see that here.
Correct. And the authority has no desire to change any of that. All the number of booths that the city of Arroyo Grande wants to have will be your decision. Who staffs those booths is your decision. We're not going to change any of that. So
just once we've selected them, you're going to take it from there.
We will keep that same process that you have. The only thing we're going to do is the people that are selected each year to staff the booths, they will have one meeting to go to, one set of dates and times to follow, one permit fee to follow, and that sort of thing.
Thank you.
Okay. This is not a public hearing, but it is an important item in the community. If anyone in the audience would like to come forward and comment on this item, this would be an opportunity. Anyone? Okay. Seeing no one, we'll bring it back to the council. We'll start to my right with Council Member Guthrie.
Yeah, I don't see any problems here. I think that, you know, pulling together with one fire authority, clearly pulling together as much as possible so that you're not enforcing different rules in different places. I'm actually a little surprised that you left the New Year's in Grover and didn't allow it everywhere else. But other than that, I concur here. This is an obvious step forward. Thank you. I can support it.
Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Brown?
I agree. It's a great idea.
Okay. Councilmember Ray?
It's always fun when we have no-brainers. Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem?
And this is just a logical extension of the types of economies that we're trying to accomplish with the fire service. I'll support this 100%.
Yeah, and I'll make it unanimous. This was one of the first things that I remember when Mike came in as the chief of when the authority was first formed. And it was one of the first questions I asked him was how long would it take to standardize the fireworks ordinance? And I know that he started working on it then, but apparently it's taken a while, so I'm glad we're here. So I can support it as well, and I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I move that City Council agrees to pursue the standardization of the weed abatement process, the procedures for the sale of safe and sane fireworks throughout the five cities of fire authority, jurisdictional boundaries, and direct city attorney to return with the necessary amendments to the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code and related actions to reflect the processes established by the authority.
All right, we have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
All right, discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Ray?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay, we're going to move on to item 11B, and this is consideration of an ordinance amending Title II of the Administration and Personnel of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code. And K, Kelly, this is yours, huh?
Yes, it is. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. The proposed ordinance in front of you tonight amends portions of Title II of the Rio Grande Municipal Code relating to administration and personnel. Specifically, the majority of the revisions update city department names and staff titles that have changed as a result of citywide restructuring, as well as provide updates and functional areas of responsibility among city departments to reflect current practices. I won't go through the amendments line by line, but if you have questions, I'm available to answer those. The ordinance was reviewed by both the city manager and the city attorney to ensure that it is internally consistent with the city's current organizational structure and functional responsibilities. Staff recommends the council introduce the ordinance tonight. It would come back at the next meeting for final adoption. And with that, I'd answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Anyone in the public like to come forward on this item? Seeing none, we'll bring it back. And discussion and action.
I'm fine with this. Obviously, we need to make sure that our codes match what we're saying we're doing. So I'm in full support.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yeah, I also support this. I mean, it's cleaning up the who's responsible for which decisions is obviously an important item.
All right. Councilmember Brown?
I agree, and I appreciate staff work on the issue.
Okay. And Mayor Pro Tem?
I agree also.
All right. I love items like this. Mm-hmm. Make it unanimous, and we need a motion.
I move the City Council introduce an ordinance amending Title II, Administrative and Personnel of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code.
Second.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none. Roll call.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Ray?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay. We're going to move on the agenda. Item 12 is city council member items. We have none. City manager items, none this evening, Steve. Council communication, any announcements, correspondence?
Just mentioning that I will be missing from the next council meeting. Be out of town.
Okay. Anything? I do have one item and that I'd like to bring up, and with a request to put it under council member items to be discussed, and it relates to the sanitation district. And members of the board have brought up the notion or the idea of expanding the sanitation district board to 5 members instead of 3. And historically, the district has had one board member representing each of the member agencies. And so that's Arroyo Grande, City of Arroyo Grande, City of Grover Beach, Oceano Community Services District. The board is asking for feedback, and they're asking this in Grover Beach and also with OCSD, as to the advantages, disadvantages, thoughts from the member agencies on the concept of expanding to 5 members. And they can, you know, a couple of examples of who they may be. They might be at-large members. They could be, we could invite the county to participate again. They did participate on the board at one time, and I'm not sure when it happened, but it was a number of years ago. They pulled off of the board. Their thinking was that the majority of the actions taken for the sanitation district really didn't impact or affect the county that much. I'm not sure if there were some other reasons or rationale, but anyway, what I'd like you to do is, first of all, think about it. And I guess the only issue that I want to bring up for your thought process before we bring it back is that if we do go to an at-large process, then we would look at potentially leaving one jurisdiction out of a vote because we have 3 member agencies. So it gets a little bit complex. We could in fact wind up with two members of one member agency's jurisdiction on the board, and one of us would be one short. So, anyway, if you could just think about advantages, disadvantages, recommendations, and I'd like to carry that information back to the Sanitation District Board. So I'd like to put it in, if we're asking for a consensus like that, Tim, do I need to put it on as a new business item, or can I leave it under council member items?
I'd recommend you put it on as a business item so you really can expand the discussion and take whatever action is appropriate.
Okay. Let's do that. And let's put it on as a new business item if everyone is okay with that. That way we can maybe get some public input as well. Okay. Item 15 is staff communication. And Steve, anything tonight?
No, sir.
All right. 16 is community comments and suggestions. This is our final community comments and suggestions. Anyone who would like to come forward? Seeing none, we will go to item 17, and this is our adjournment to closed session. And this will be a closed session on existing litigation, as is described on item 18. We will reconvene to open session, but more than likely we will give if there is a report to be given, it will be given at the next regularly scheduled council meeting. So the council will adjourn to closed session at this time.